Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Too much of a good thing is never good. That goes for video games, and it's not just because they turn players into proverbial couch potato. A new study links violent video games with negative racial stereotypes and aggression. Joining us is OSU Communications and Psychology Professor Brad Bushman to talk about his research. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, we've talked about video games and violence before.
Yes, we have.
So we're boring down a little deeper now today to get to a particular issue, and that's the racial part of this equation. Describe the experiments you conducted and explain how they link black video game characters to negative stereotypes and aggression.
Sure. We actually did two studies, and the problem with most video games is if there's a black character in the game, that character is almost always a violent character. And so we thought that...
You mean when there's a choice, so you could have peaceful characters in a...
Well, if there are peaceful characters, probably you can't choose a black one.
Okay.
So in the first study, we had people play the video game Saints Row 2, and they played it in a violent way or a nonviolent way. The violent way was we put them in a prison and told them that their mission was to break out of the prison. The nonviolent way, we told them that their mission was to find a church in the city. And so to break out of a prison, you have to kill a bunch of people, and to find a church, you don't have to kill anybody. And then we had them play this game as either a black character or as a white character. All our participants were white. And then afterwards, we measured both explicit racism. It had a standardized scale that has items such as, it's really a matter of some people not trying hard enough. If blacks would only try harder, they could be just as well off as whites. So just explicit.
That kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Yep. But we also had an implicit measure. Your listeners can Google IAT. It stands for the Implicit Association Test. And in that test, participants see photos of black faces and white faces paired with either good words such as wonderful, glorious, happy, or with bad words such as terrible, horrible, evil. And we see if we measure their reaction time, and we see if their reaction time is faster when black faces are paired with bad words than when white faces are paired with bad words.
And you do this after they've played this game?
That's correct.
All right, so you had the two different games. You had the peaceful game and the violent game.
As a black character or a white character. And what we found is participants who played the violent game as a black character, they had more explicit racist attitudes. They're more likely to think, for example, that black people are lazy. And they also had more implicit racist attitudes. They were faster in linking black faces to bad words in comparison to people who played exactly the same game, but as a white character.
How do you know that the game is the source of the racial attitudes and that they didn't have those before they played the game?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We didn't ask them if they wanted what game they wanted to play, a violent or nonviolent one, nor did we ask them if they wanted to be a black character or a white character. Because if we asked them, maybe different types of people would choose to play the game violently, and different types of people would choose to play to choose a black character. And then we wouldn't know if it's the type of person or the game. So in this case, what we did is we randomly assigned them to play either a violent one or a nonviolent version. So you can't say, oh, all the aggressive people played the violent version, because there's a 50-50 chance that those aggressive people would play the nonviolent version. And likewise, you can't say, oh, all the racist people, they played as a black avatar, because there is a 50-50 chance they played as a white avatar. So we flipped a coin to determine.
How did you know going into the experiment that you had a good sample of racist, non-racist, violent, non-violent types of people? And that, I know I'm... you know, way oversimplifying, but...
Yeah, well, they were college students, and they were from a variety of disciplines, and The experiment was required, so it's not like everybody has to do some experiments. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any reason to believe. It could be that college students are different than other people. But my guess is if that's true, they would be less racist than other people. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because in college, we're taught a lot. We teach a lot about valuing people regardless of their skin color or gender, things like that. So it's just a broad base of college students in America.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you have a question or comment about our discussion about how some video games can affect people's attitudes about race, particularly violent video games, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How often or how long does a person need to play these types of video games in order to show the negative racially charged effects that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In our study, they only played 20 minutes, so it didn't take long at all. And if you'd like, I can tell you about the second study as well.
Okay.
Because scientists always like to replicate their findings to make sure they're reliable. So in the second study, participants played a violent game, either a wrestling game or a boxing game, as either a black avatar or as a white avatar. They did the implicit association test again, but this time, instead of black and white faces being linked with good and bad words, the black and white faces were linked with weapons, such as guns, knives, hand grenades, or with harmless objects, such as cell phones, cameras, and tennis rackets. And so, and then we told them there's actually two studies. The first study, they'd play a video game, and then in the second study, we described it as a taste test study. And they had a partner in that study, and at the beginning, they filled out a questionnaire indicating what kind of foods they liked, and their partner said, "I like almost all foods, but I hate spicy foods," right? And then through a rigged lottery, we had the real participants eat pretzels, and their partners ate hot sauce. And so the way we measured aggression was we measured the number of grams of hot sauce they gave their partner. They were told their partner had to eat all the food to get a valid rating of the food. And so their partner hates spicy food, and they get to choose how much spicy food their partner eats. And so that's how we measured aggression, was the amount of hot sauce they gave their partner to eat who hates spicy foods.
Knowing that their partner hated
spicy foods. And what we found in that study is participants that, once again, they played exactly the same games. Those who played as a black avatar were more likely to associate black faces with weapons, and they gave their partner over twice as much hot sauce to eat compared to those who played the game as a white avatar.
What do we know about how video game avatars of any race affect aggression and stereotypes? What's going on in the brain?
Yeah, we don't know. But this study, for many people, African-American men, especially, and the characters in our video games were all African-American men. For many people, they are stereotypically violent. And our research shows that these video games just reinforce those stereotypes that black men are violent characters.
You've done a lot of other research on violent video games. As I mentioned, you've been on the show before to talk about that. How do the results of these studies fit in with your other findings?
Well, we recently did a comprehensive review of all video game studies that looked at violent games. We found 381 effects from studies involving over 130,000 participants. And these studies show that playing violent video games increase aggressive thoughts, they increase angry feelings, They increase physiological arousal, such as heart rate and blood pressure, which might explain why they also increase aggressive behavior, such as hot sauce, or some people use electric shocks, or loud blasts of unpleasant noise, or how much time a participant has to stick their hand in ice-cold water. Or if they're kids, they just measure, or they kicking kids or pushing them down or tripping them on the during recess. And these violent games also decrease feelings of empathy and compassion for others, and they decrease helping behavior, such as how long you take to help somebody who's in pain. These studies actually are above and beyond those effects, because we're not comparing a violent versus a non-violent game. We're comparing exactly the same violent game. The only difference is, in one condition, you play as a black avatar, and the other condition, you play as a white avatar. So on top of the aggression-enhancing effects for violent games in general, there's this additional effect that if you play the game as a black avatar, you're even more aggressive than if you play as a white avatar.
Recent research from the Oxford Internet Institute and the University of Rochester links aggression to player incompetence and gameplay mechanics as opposed to violent content. So you're more aggressive, the worse player you are, the more aggressive you are. How does this compare with your research?
Yeah, we control for all of that in our studies. We ask participants how frustrating the game was. So if you're competent, you're going to be more frustrated. How challenging the game was, how competitive the game was, how enjoyable, interesting, arousing, addicting. We measure a host of differences between the game other than the violent content, and we always statistically control for those. So that the only difference we're looking at is the difference for the violent content.
What are your expectations will be done with research like this going forward? Is this something that you see the game, developers looking at and taking seriously and adjusting to, or is it something that parents and people should be aware of about what their children are playing and what they're playing themselves?
Both. I think it's damaging to society as a whole to have any product that reinforces stereotypes that blacks are dangerous, they're violent. And violent video games do just that when you play as a black character. But also, I would love to see video game producers develop games in which black characters can help people rather than kill people, maybe heal people, maybe a physician. So you play a game as a doctor, and you can choose the race of the doctor, and maybe the black doctor can save someone's life instead of gunning them down.
Do you, right now, the way video games are rated, do you think that they reflect what you're talking about from your research? There's mature, there's teens, there's
right.
Different ratings. All.
Yeah, well, the rating system in America is like alphabet soup. It's just a mess. For one thing, the different letters, the reason I say it's alphabet soup mm-hmm. is different letters are used for different media. So you have like TVPG versus R-rated versus M-rated. So all the ratings are different. Most countries, at least in Europe, they have a standard rating. It's age-based, like 18 plus for players 18 and older, 16 plus. They use it for TV. They use it for video games. They use it for movies. If there's violence in it, there's a fist on it. If there's no violence, there's a fist with a line through it.
Mm-hmm.
The ratings are assigned by like child development experts who really understand the research on what harms kids. In America, all the ratings are assigned by the industry. So it's a big problem. But we have what we have. And, I'm not so concerned about adults 18 and older playing violent video games that are M-rated. Those are for players 17 and older.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm really concerned about is children playing age-inappropriate video games. Nobody under 17 should be playing an M-rated game.
Brad Bushman, thanks for joining us again.
You're
we
welcome.
Really appreciate it. Brad Bushman, he is a communications and psychology professor at Ohio State. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks a lot. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When the internet first emerged, it seemed like it had the potential to change everything. But as one writer points out, maybe the internet isn't that revolutionary. Instead of creating a whole new system, the internet has just caused a rearrangement of the old system, I guess, sort of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. With us to discuss her book, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, is writer and activist Astra Taylor. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You begin the book by noting certain assumptions we've made in the past, or maybe some people still do. One, that because it has completely changed how we consume our media, it has rendered moot any concerns about, say, commercialization and media consolidation that we see, say, on television or in newspapers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, online, we're all sort of, it seems like we're all in charge of our own media destinies. Nobody can tell us what to click, what to pay attention to. And so there, understandably, was a lot of idealism around that. We would finally be liberated from the old media model, from the mainstream media of yore, which had so many problems, and that these upstart new technologies would vanquish these old dinosaurs. But I think what we're seeing is that actually it's not an age of extinction for these old media dinosaurs. Actually, it's an age of adaptation, and we're seeing the upstarts become increasingly like the old guys they were supposed to overthrow, and we're seeing the old guys adapt, and we're seeing an age of merger and acquisitions and consolidation. And so we really have to actually go back and get some of our old school media critiques out from the closet. We thought we wouldn't need them again, and put them to use, because the media landscape is evolving swiftly in troubling ways.
A second assumption you consider is that traditional gatekeepers will crumble and middlemen will wither. In other words, the idea of the even playing field where artists and writers and anyone who has a message to get out there will reach their audiences directly.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful image, and it's one I'm really, on a sort of instinctual level inclined to cheer on, because I've always been involved in independent media from being a child with my own zine that was about animal rights and environmentalism to being an independent filmmaker. I'm more well known for making films about philosophy, actually, than I am for writing books. This is my first book, and I've been an activist, and so this idea that we will finally be able to get rid of these middlemen and gatekeepers and speak peer-to-peer is a very appealing one. But what we're seeing is that the disruption, which is the word that's often used, the disruption that the internet was supposed to facilitate has not been even. It's been very uneven. And so while certain areas are struggling, like, journalism is a good example, with the funding model for investigative journalism eroding. Mm-hmm. Advertising has strengthened, or high-speed trading of derivatives is now possible thanks to new technologies, or surveillance is easier for the government than ever before. So we're seeing this uneven disruption, and we have to be very aware of what that means and how certain middlemen are actually stronger than ever. And what we have, there's all this talk of the gatekeepers. There, and people wanted to, be able to go through without having, editors and publishers and experts in the way. Mm-hmm. But what we have now are these new gateways, things like Google and Facebook that are they're ubiquitous. They're almost always in the background, and we relate to them in a very different way than we did to the gatekeepers of yore. But they're omnipresent and gaining economic and social power. And big companies like Google and Amazon actually provide the internet infrastructure for many other smaller companies and increasingly even the government. So there are these big gateways we can't avoid.
Well, talk about gatekeepers in social media, not necessarily on Twitter, but on Facebook. I'm not getting half of the posts that I used to get.
Yeah, increasingly it's turning into a pay-to-play model. Mm-hmm. So, the business is built on this idea of people connecting to their friends and family or to organizations or companies that they want to quote-unquote friend. And you're right, that people are actually seeing statistically a smaller percentage of what it is that they've chosen to like. That is partly because Facebook is trying to promote a new business model where it's not what's best that rises to the top, but what is the most lucrative for Facebook. So these social platforms are increasingly warped by business incentives. And that's why the fundamental argument of the book is that we can't depend on technology alone. If we want a media revolution, there actually has to be an economic revolution as well, because technology cannot transcend market imperatives. And in fact, so much of tech is rooted in Silicon Valley venture capitalism, mm-hmm. which is very focused on big time, financial gain and profitability and not long-term serving of the public interest.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Astra Taylor. She's the author of a new book. It's called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. If you have a question or comment for Astra, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. You write that this new system created by the internet has new winners and losers. First of all, one of the things that occurs to me is there are fewer people controlling what's on the internet than you would imagine. It's more consolidated than maybe we thought it would be 10 years ago.
Yeah. What's interesting is this sort of surprising tendency towards monopoly online. So there was this image that we would kind of have a free market paradise where, the barriers to entry would be low and you wouldn't need that much to start up a new company and, you wouldn't need, the gatekeeper's permission to contribute online. But what we've seen is actually that, this small number of giant tech companies really dominate, and that has to do with network effects, which is basically the fact that online, the more people who use one service, the more useful that service becomes. So the reason everyone's on Facebook is because that's where you can connect to everybody. It would be very inefficient if you're on some smaller platform. So these network effects encourage the dominance of a few players, and that, of course, leads to a corresponding economic dominance, so then they can buy up the competition. And what's amazing is that these companies that are enormous in terms of their revenue, they're some of the biggest companies on earth. Apple is constantly jockeying to be number two, and Google is up there, employ very few people. So in that sense, your comment's right on, which is that so giant companies that literally actually employ very few people, which mm-hmm. means very few people are in charge. And it is a surprising development, and one we really have to take into consideration when we're thinking about the implications of the internet and what kind of media landscape we want to see develop.
So who are the losers? We know the winners. We know them by name. Mm-hmm. Who are the losers?
Well, I think it's complicated in the sense that from our own perspective, it is important to acknowledge that we the internet's brought us a bounty of benefits. And so this book is not anti-technological in any way. I'm trying to make the argument that if we want all the good things associated with it, we have to actually intervene and create some incentives and structures that can allow those productive possibilities to develop. So, but right now the losers are us in different ways, from the example of you saying that you're not seeing the things you want to see on social media. These are supposed to be platforms where people can connect with others. And instead they're increasingly being corralled to connect with advertisers. There are ways that old social hierarchies also carry over into digital space. We're seeing a lot of awareness right now about harassment of women online, and that's one thing I discuss in my book. So social hierarchies have carried over. There was the old famous New Yorker cartoon that said, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And there's this idea that we could all sort of transcend our circumstances and almost communicate in a more pure way. And what we're seeing now is that actually, if you come out online, you know, often as female or as part of another marginalized group, you'll be harassed and trolled. And the statistics are shocking. So some scientists did a study and found that a female username will lead to 25 times as many hateful and negative comments as a male username. So there are ways in which, you know, all of the losers of the you know, pre-internet age are very much the losers of the internet age, and there's something about this technology that can actually amplify the old inequities. So in that sense, I'd say the breakdown between winners and losers hasn't changed that much.
Brian in Grandview, you're on the air with Astra Taylor. Welcome, Brian.
Hello. I'm really interested in what you were talking about. I'm a musician, and I play in a duo, and we kind of like experience a lot of what you're talking about. For example, we were using MySpace for a while to upload our material so that people could, you know, go to MySpace and listen to it. The old days where you used to run around with a CD and actually hand it to somebody, people don't do that anymore. And the next thing we knew, MySpace changed their whole format, and everything was wiped out. And then everybody's using Facebook. Facebook used to have a music player, and they don't even have a way for you to download your music. You have to use something like SoundCloud or something like that. But we've noticed, like, you can spend years and years trying to upload things, you know, trying to get a nice presentation, and then they just come along, like you said, the gatekeepers, and they just kind of, like, wipe everything out. And is there anything for a musician to do nowadays?
What you're saying is really important, and especially as the corresponding side to this idea that the gatekeepers will crumble is that each of us as journalists or artists or whatever our art form might be, will kind of go out on our own, and we'll build our own audience. And the way to do that, we've been told, is to invest in these social media platforms and do exactly what you're doing. And as you say, the risk is precisely that these businesses will just change everything. This is why analogies, you know, people who say Google is like a library or Flickr is like a museum or an archive, or that Twitter is a public square, why those analogies are so misleading and false, because these actually aren't custodians of our cultural creativity or our heritage. They're private companies that have to adapt their business models to seek out revenue. And that's why, you know, these services we depend on occasionally do just disappear overnight, or, you know, as you say, something changes. So I think as filmmakers and writers and musicians, we have to be pretty skeptical about not putting all of our eggs into those baskets and actually going back to the old-fashioned way of building our own independent websites when we can and trying to get people to visit us there instead. And I'd like to see, you know, nonprofit alternatives. There are some associations. There's a group called Cash Music, I forget what the acronym stands for right now, that provides nonprofit tech resources for musicians to build their own websites. Because of the risks that you're discussing. So I think that's definitely a concern. And the business models for these companies is just, you know, try to generate as much of a market share as you can, try to attract as many users. And then then once they've got that gigantic user base, they try to find a way to make money. And that's when, you know, you feel a little bit of a bait and switch, because there's some service that's useful, but then they realize actually it's unprofitable and they end it. So we have to proceed with caution and try to develop our own independent, non-commercial spaces.
Thanks a lot, Brian, for that call. What is your expectation in the future if nothing changes, if we continue on this trajectory?
Oh, I think then we'll see, you know, increasing commercialization. You know, Google just filed for a patent of a camera mounted into a contact lens. So, you know, a deeper integration with these advertising-driven entities, I think, is on the horizon. And, you know, and more mergers like the Time Warner Comcast merger, which would mean that, you know, we live in an era of vertical integration, which is kind of like the future suddenly resembles the past. You know, one company will be controlling the pipes through which we access online spaces and also creating the content that we're viewing. Even if our experience is highly personalized or targeted, the paradox will be that there will be just a shrinking number of companies behind the curtain. But I think people are getting fed up. And a recent Reuters poll actually said that 51% of Americans feel like these tech companies are encroaching on their lives too much. Another poll showed that, you know, people actually trust the IRS far more than Facebook with their privacy. So there's been a real shift in public opinion. I mean, there's some things happened, and probably a lot of it is due to Ed Snowden and the team of reporters working on the stories about the collusion between the NSA and the corporate tech sector. So I think people are actually, I think public opinion is really shifting away from the old tech utopianism and towards something much more astute and interesting.
Marilyn in Columbus, you're on the air with Astra Taylor. Hi, Marilyn.
Oh, hello. I am wanting to find out about how public's going public or companies going public has affected the internet.
What do you mean by also, companies going public?
When they IPO.
From a private business to being publicly traded.
Okay. All right.
And also the net neutrality that was in controversy at the governmental level and the legislation that was passed connected with net neutrality.
I don't think we'll have time for both questions, Marilyn, but Astra, maybe you could take a swipe at the first one.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens when you're publicly traded is that you're much more intensely answerable to your shareholders who are demanding returns on investment. So suddenly a company like Facebook, which could sit back and kind of let us, connect with our friends, suddenly has to frantically look for new revenue sources. So they're suddenly partnering with firms that actually track our purchases in the offline world, or they are investing in this pay-to-play model where you promote updates. So what it does is it intensifies the quest for profits, which in an advertising-driven digital economy means intensifying the tracking and surveillance of us and looking for new means to make predictive marketing pitches at us. So that's the risk of that business model, is that it creates certain imperatives. And quickly on the net neutrality thing, other countries are so far ahead of us. Brazil just passed very inspiring net neutrality legislation. The Netherlands and Chile already have it as law. And so there's good news in other parts of the world, and we need to start paying attention to countries that are doing it better than us.
Astra Taylor, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Astra Taylor, she's the author of a new book. It's called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday with Russell Holly from Geek.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, news broke that many websites were not as secure as we thought due to the so-called Heartbleed bug. Joining us now to tell us if we really need to change all our passwords and talk about other tech news is Russell Holly, blogger for Geek.com. Hi, Russell.
Hey.
So are you worried about the Heartbleed bug?
It's definitely something to be aware of. But there's not a ton that we can do about it just yet. It's up to each individual company that we do business with as users to issue these fixes. And it's not until those fixes are issued that we as users can do anything, you know, short of shutting down our accounts and you know, removing our information from their services. But even then, this is one of those things where it's really detached from the consumer business relationship. This is something that's kind of off to the side that you know, as users, we kind of have to wait before we do anything.
What is it? I mean, why is that? What's the heartbleed bug? What does it do?
So lots and lots of companies use this this system called OpenSSL, and it's a security layer whose job it is to, you know, protect all of our information that's stored by these companies, and also their own information. And this bug is something that, if used correctly, can someone can make a request against that server and get more than they're supposed to back, and so that causes a problem because they can grab tons and tons of information. But it has to be done in a very specific way. And in some cases, it has to be done hundreds of thousands of times before the server even accidentally gets that information that it's not supposed to. So it's a really weird, complicated bug that has to be, you know, very carefully patched and taken care of. And once that has happened, then you can change your password for those services so that if someone has attacked that site or service using the Heartbleed bug and they gained information, then that information isn't useful to them.
So they're out there telling us to change all our passwords and to make every password different and that kind of thing, but you're saying until the server, or until, you know, the larger servers change things, it won't really matter.
Well, there's two things to keep in mind. The first is that if you change your password before you know, let's say Facebook, for example. Facebook is already updated against this, but you know, if Facebook had not updated against Heartbleed yet, then changing your password doesn't actually accomplish anything.
Okay.
You changed your password, but someone who would attack Facebook to get that information could still do it if they hadn't already updated to defend against Heartbleed. So, like, my bank, for example, sent me an email last night that said, you know, we were vulnerable to Heartbleed, but we have issued a patch to fix it, and so now is the time to go and change your password. If
okay.
I had changed my password yesterday, then it wouldn't have done me any good. I would still have to go and change my password in the event that someone had gotten information from my bank about my login information.
Okay. So when someone tells you to change your password, it's somebody you know, do it.
Right. And I mean, you may not get an email from every single company. It's important to, you know, check their news feeds or their, you know, their press release sites or something like that. You need to know that they have updated against Heartbleed in order to change your password, because otherwise it's not going to matter. But there's still places where that's kind of a problem, and that's Android phones. There are Android phones that are version 4.1.1, if memory serves, that are, all of them are vulnerable to Heartbleed. And in order for that update to happen, the entire phone would have to receive an update. So like Sprint and AT&T and Verizon, the companies who have these phones would have to push updates out in order to protect against Heartbleed. That's going to take a really long time.
Well, Russell, is there another Heartbleed bleed coming around the mountain? I mean, is this just going to be the way it is?
Well, I mean, so the funny thing about OpenSSL is that it is a community managed and maintained project for security. And the idea was that, behind a lot of open source projects, that if all the code is out in the open for everyone to see, then these kind of things are less likely to happen. There's no such thing as 100% secure, but there are tons of things you can do to make yourself more secure. And while security companies have been, making sure that everyone is doing the right thing as far as Heartbleed goes, there are things that we as users can do to protect ourselves against this kind of thing from happening again. The first thing is, you know, look for services that have what's called two-factor authentication. This is a really big deal that most major websites have now. Facebook, Google, Apple.
What do you call that again?
It's called two-factor authentication.
Okay, two-factor authentication. Okay.
So I have an app on my phone, for example, for Google, and when I go to Gmail on a computer that I've never been to or a computer that I have been to and just have it turned off on, I can enter in my normal password for my Gmail account, and then Gmail will respond by asking me for my second authentication code. From that point, I go to the app on my phone, and that app has a 6-digit code that is regularly changing. It changes every 15 seconds. And so I have to look down at my phone and grab that number and punch that in, and only then am I granted access to the service. I use two-factor authentication for my bank accounts, for my PayPal account, for my email, for the really important things that I have in my life. I use either Google's provided two-factor authentication or a service called LastPass.
Uh-huh.
LastPass is a web service that enables two-factor authentication for a ton of different websites, and it's really, really simple to use. I would definitely recommend people checking it out. It's a free service for kind of the basic version, and then they have a premier version that allows you to do some really interesting security things if you're really interested in making sure that you're completely protected, including a separate USB key that you could use for your computer. So that passwords don't work at all unless that key is inserted in your computer.
Okay. All right. Lots of good information. Thanks, Russell. Now on to gadgetry. If anyone has a question about anything for Russell Holley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you can reduce it to 140 characters. You can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. So you want to talk about the download booster on the Samsung S5 phone.
Well, this is actually something that it really made me mad because I got to use this when they first announced it, and I thought that it was a really cool idea. Samsung, for the Galaxy S5, implemented this tool so that when you are downloading apps, like big apps, maybe you're downloading a game or you're downloading a movie just before getting on an airplane, or you know, some music before you're about to go offline, or something like that. Maybe you're just watching a big video on YouTube or something like that. This software it uses your LTE connection, your mobile radio connection, and your wireless internet connection at the same time to make the download happen faster. It's really technical to describe how exactly this happens, but it uses both of these services at the same time. And the end result is a way faster download for all of these things.
So why are you mad?
Because we don't get to use it. Sprint, Verizon, and AT&T all removed the service from the Samsung Galaxy S5. If you
why?
Go into a store and purchase any one of these phones, that feature just never exists. It's not an app that you can install. It is completely gone from these phones.
Why would they do that?
Because in order to use the service and actually enjoy it, you're tapping your LTE connection to use these to download all these features, which is consuming potentially a lot more data than you normally would.
Yeah, but if you're willing to pay for it, or are
exactly.
these
the... That's exactly my point. The point that I made when I first made this discovery is that, you know, I pay a certain amount of money each month for, you know, AT&T, I think AT&T's big thing right now is 10 gigs of data, you know, for all their commercials that you could share.
Uh-huh.
If I plan my month so that I use that 10 gigs of data, and even if I go over and pay the overages, you know, that's my right as a consumer to do that.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, they seem to disagree. And this it would be weird if this was the first time that this has happened, but it's AT&T and Verizon. And even Sprint at times have had services removed from phones that they felt would be data intensive. When the iPhone was new on AT&T, FaceTime didn't work on their LTE, on their 3G and LTE connections because they felt that it would be too data intensive to use.
Now, I mean, I'm one of those people that I'm always getting ripped off at buffets because I never eat enough food to justify the cost of the buffet. And that is the same way with my data usage. I pay for more than I actually ever use. And I guess that's one of the ways they make money, right?
that's certainly it. I mean, I am.
When you're using a booster like that, you're maybe using all the data you're paying for.
Right. Wouldn't that be weird if you actually use the stuff that you
Very
pay
strange,
for?
Strange, yeah.
From your carrier. So yeah, unfortunately, it's not there. If you want the feature bad enough, you can get it on AT&T, and you can get it on T-Mobile just by buying it outright, just by buying a Galaxy S5 on T-Mobile. Mm-hmm. But if you are on AT&T and want to use it, you can purchase what's called an unlocked version of the phone. You end up having to pay the full price for the phone outright, but you can order it from Amazon or even from Samsung directly or from an electronics store like Best Buy. And that version of the phone would still have the app on it.
Okay. Moving on from our disgruntled consumer segment is the Microsoft Windows Phone 8.1.
Yes. This was really surprising. Microsoft, they have an annual conference that they call Build, and they got up on stage and started talking about the new updates to Windows, and then they pulled one of their phones out, and they started talking about Windows Phone 8.1. And they took their mobile experience and made some really dramatic changes to the user interface. It looks really nice. There's a ton of new, including a voice assistant that gives Siri a run for its money that is called Cortana.
Well, I think Siri gives Siri a run for its money, but the new update, will the new operating system, is it going to take a lot for people to learn how to use it? You know, mere mortals, not like you.
The really cool thing is that it still all looks just like Windows Phone. It's like Windows Phone with a few extra things on the side almost. You know, you still have all of the same menu functions are all the same. The commands are all the same. The biggest difference is the search button on the phone. When you tap it, it launches Cortana instead of the Bing search app, and you get this voice assistant that works really well.
Called Cortana.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's Microsoft's answer to Siri.
That is Microsoft's answer to Siri, and it is very, very good. It is, in the tests that I've done so far, it is certainly more capable than Siri most of the time. It did try to tell me to go to airport to get Starbucks once, and that was kind of weird. but otherwise, it's been really good.
All right, and one new feature is called Glance, and it lets you quickly check your phone. What are you glancing at?
So if you, I have a problem, and this is something that I probably have a problem with because of how I use my phone, but I get way too many notifications for email, for Twitter, for, you know, the different social networks, and for email from my boss and stuff like that. Glance lets me filter out which of these notifications I think is the most important and puts it on the screen so that when I take my hand and wave it over my phone, it just it lights up for a second and lets me see those notifications. I never have to touch the phone. It can sit on my desk and I can wave my hand over it even now when I'm on the phone with you and see that my boss has, in fact, emailed me since we started this call. So, I mean, there's this, you know, it's this kind of you know, distraction-free method of taking a look down at what's going on without, you know, interrupting a meeting or anything like that.
Well, I would like to know how you can email and listen to this show at the same time, but that's
he
another question.
A multi-talented individual.
Let's move on to Google Glass. It's available today. Just even somebody like me can get Google Glass?
Anybody in the United States can get it today. It is only available today. Google has opened their Explorer program. Well, because it's still in beta. It's still this kind of early thing. But they've opened their Explorer program so that anyone in the U.S. can purchase it today and take the Explorer thing, which means giving feedback and you know, letting Google know what you think about the stuff that you've done so far and actually seeing changes made to Glass based on that feedback. You know, anybody in the U.S. can go to glass.google.com today and actually go through and purchase it. It's still $1,500, and you get either the glasses frames like I have where you can put prescription lenses in them, or the sunshades, you know, whichever one of those things is the most appealing to you, and they will ship it right to your house.
Okay, for a mere $1,500. Russell Holly, thanks a lot once again for joining us today, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening today on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.